Is there any connection that you would make between diseases, viruses, and because I've seen a little bit about that in the news?
Yeah, I think just in terms of there has to be a kind of a global response, right? There has to be a united effort on the part of the international political community to respond to the climate issue, just as people are trying to respond to this this pandemic. So I think it and it shows us that it is possible to come together and take some important and necessary actions to try to deal with a crisis, right?
That's true. Well, in your new book, Carbon Criminals, Climate Crimes, Rob White, in the foreword, refers to climate change as, quote-unquote, the most significant crime of the 21st century. So let's settle that debate here and now. What causes climate change? Is it really man-made, and not only man-made, but also a criminal act?
Well, there's simply no doubt that it's humanly caused. There are anthropogenic factors, as they say, human factors that are responsible. That's clearly established by the science. It's the activities that humans engage in, particularly the burning of fossil fuels and, to some extent, the efforts at causing deforestation that lead to the release of greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere. And, of course, they trap the outgoing heat and then re-emit it and causes the Earth to warm. And as the Earth warms, then various forms of climate changes start to occur, climate disruption. So yes, it's definitely humanly caused. And my argument is that it does fall into the category of criminal act because the organizations that are responsible for the burning of fossil fuels and to some extent for deforestation have known about this for years and years and years, and yet they've continued to engage in these activities that that lead to climate disruption. And certainly, you know, if we go back far enough to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, people weren't aware of what effect the burning of fossil fuels was going to have. But as we move forward into the 20th century, we certainly have very strong scientific evidence beginning to emerge early in the century, and certainly by mid-century, the evidence was very strong that we couldn't continue to do this. And yet, one of my chapters is on continued extraction of fossil fuels. And so at some point we knew that we couldn't continue to do this and, avoid climate disruption. And yet it was business as usual. There were economic and political forces that combined to keep us on a business as normal pathway, a pathway that did result in greater climate harm. And so that's one of the crimes that I'm discussing and analyzing in the book.
So as we get a little deeper into this, if you could define for our listeners a couple of phrases that you use, green criminology, and what do you mean by climate justice?
Green criminology is a term that was created by a criminologist by the name of Michael Lynch. He was interested in environmental harms and violations of environmental law. And so the term green criminology just came to him as a way to kind of capture this new focus within the discipline of criminology, that criminologists ought to be studying environmental harms and analyzing them and analyzing environmental law and the violation of environmental law and efforts that societies make to try to deal with those environmental harms. So that's what's meant by green criminology.
And climate justice, what would climate justice be?
Well, climate change is unfair.
Yes.
It's unfair in a lot of ways. One of the ways in which climate change is unfair is that it's often affecting those in the global south first and foremost. They have had the least responsibility for causing climate disruption. Their emissions are relatively low. They're not responsible for the problem, and yet global warming and the impact of climate disruption is affecting particularly the tropics area and causing all kinds of problems, storms and droughts and you know, agricultural failures and increasing heat waves. And so the people in the global south are being affected, and yet they're not responsible. And so climate justice means that we would attempt to deal with their suffering, to try to respond to the concerns that they have first and foremost. And I think that can be extended into other areas. Often, of course, in even in northern industrial societies, the poor will suffer first and foremost from any kind of climate problems and climate disruption. Workers in the fossil fuel industry, for example, we know that fossil fuels are going to have to stay in the ground. And yet it's not fair to fossil fuel workers just to say, hey, you're out of a job. So there has to be some notion of a transition for workers in the fossil fuel industry into other areas of employment, particularly, of course, helping to create clean, renewable energy in a variety of ways, solar and wind. And so we need to have a just transition for workers that are likely to be affected. So climate change is an ethical issue. It raises all kinds of questions about fairness and justice. And so climate justice is just a broad term for us to think about and address those different forms of unfairness and see if we can do something to rectify them.
You know, I've always thought that rather than saying global warming, because I'll hear people say, oh, it's not that warm, it seems like we should increasingly be using the term extreme weather when we talk to the general public. What are your thoughts on that?
I use both global warming and climate disruption in the book, if you noticed. And
yeah.
Increasingly, the language that I think we should be using is climate crisis or climate emergency.
Good point.
So,
yeah.
Of course, as global temperatures begin to rise significantly over the pre-industrial average, then that causes various forms of climate change or climate disruption. And those changes or disruptions are getting to the point where they constitute a real crisis for the planet. It's really an emergency that we need to respond to. So, and of course, extreme weather is one of the factors, one of the disruptions, one of the aspects of the emergency that we're facing, but it's not the only one. So, you know, in the book, I try to use the language of climate disruption, climate crisis, climate emergency to try to signal to the readers that, hey, this is something that we really have to respond to. This is really a serious issue that needs to be addressed.
Who are the most guilty that you address in this book, and what is it that makes them so guilty?
Well, in the second chapter, I address the question of responsibility, who's responsible for climate disruption. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, we can identify 90 organizations that are responsible for about 70% of all the greenhouse gas emissions going back to 1751. there's actually been quite a bit of research on this. And so the term that those researchers use is the carbon majors. And so mostly these are corporations. In some cases, they're government-run oil facilities. But there are a very identifiable group of organizations that are responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions over the years. And so we really need to address the actions of the carbon majors. So, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I use the concept of state corporate crime. That's a concept and theory that I developed with my friend Ray Michalowski many, many years ago. And it fits perfectly in with the analysis of climate change. It is a state corporate crime. It does involve both corporations in the fossil fuel industry and governments who have failed to take actions to mitigate their emissions and continue to encourage them to extract fossil fuels and continue to lead us down the path toward the climate crisis. And so, again, corporations and states have to first and foremost be addressed. Now, of course, we can all do things, you know, in our own personal lifestyle, right? We can all try to reduce our own carbon footprint in a variety of ways change our consumer behavior. But that's not enough. Even if everybody did that and did it very well, that wouldn't be enough unless we really get at the true source of the problem, which is the actions of these carbon majors.
That said, I think one of the interesting things that I've heard about on the news, as we're all hunkering down and shutting down and staying at home, not commuting the way that we normally would, we've seen some pretty dramatic changes, air in Los Angeles cleaning up and other large cities like that. All of a sudden, we can see a blue sky. I think you're right that we as individuals may not have that big of an effect, and I certainly don't want to discourage anybody from doing their part. But does that give you any hope that if we all work together somehow, and maybe there's something we can learn from our situation right now going forward?
Yes, I think so. In our response to the pandemic, we've made dramatic changes in our lifestyles and in our economic activity. We've demonstrated that we can pull together, we can create those changes, and we can clean up to some extent the pollution that we have created. Now, this is not the best way to go about doing that, right? We don't want to have to deal with a pandemic motivate us to deal with climate change. But I think we can take some lessons away from our response to the COVID crisis in that, yes, if government takes the lead, organize ourselves, if we respond effectively as a collectivity, as an international political community, we might be able to have a big impact on the climate crisis as well. So, you know, if we can get past the COVID pandemic, then I'm hoping that we'll draw some lessons from that to say, hey, the next big challenge that we really need to focus on is the climate crisis.
You write about four specific state corporate climate crimes in your book. I wonder if you could, in general, describe those and what could we do to turn those things around?
Sure. Well, I've mentioned one already, and that's the continued extraction of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And so that's the very first crime that I address, climate crime that I address in the book. Of course, the continued extraction of fossil fuels and the marketing of those fossil fuels causes them to be used and burned, and that leads to the emission of greenhouse gases. And so that's why greenhouse gas emissions have been rising. And so that's the major problem. Now, second problem is that governments have a responsibility here to deal with that kind of morally blameworthy, harmful behavior, and yet they haven't done it. So this is the crime of political omission. The failure of governments, both the United States government and other governments individually, but as an international political community, to really respond. In the book, I use the term predatory delay, right? That the delay in responding to the crisis, the delay in mitigating greenhouse gas emissions has caused the situation to get much worse. The term criminal negligence perhaps fits the activities of government agencies. Now, the third crime that I address is what I call socially organized climate change denial. And part of the reason that governments have failed to respond is that they've been tremendously influenced politically by a very conscious, organized effort to deny climate change. This is mostly funded by the fossil fuel industry. It operates through many conservative think tanks that have been created, and they pump out a lot of basically propaganda, trying to deny the science of climate change. They heavily invest in lobbying government officials. They make campaign contributions. And so the socially organized counter-movement to deny climate change has been very powerful and very effective, and that's part of the reasons why governments haven't done the job that they should do. The fourth type of crime is really a bit more complicated. It has to do with the way in which war and militarism and the pursuit of empire have aggravated the climate crisis. The major issue I wanted to address here is that we also have to think about adapting to climate disruptions that are going to occur no matter what. Even if we stopped all emission of fossil fuels right now, there's a certain level of climate disruption that's baked in that's going to happen no matter what. So we have to think about how are we going to adjust to that or adapt to that. Now, it seems to me that we can adapt to that in ways that are fair, climate justice, in ways that are sort of progressive, or we can do it in ways that are unfair, right, unjust, that are militaristic. And often countries around the world, including the United States, have chosen to adapt in ways that are very militaristic, build the wall, right, enforce the borders, make sure climate refugees fleeing climate disruption in Central America or in Northern Africa are not allowed to enter, not allowed to come into the global north. And so often we've responded with what's called the politics of the armed lifeboat, politics of the armed lifeboat. We in the north are in the lifeboat and safe for the moment, but we're keeping others out of the lifeboat at gunpoint right now. And so that's another form of crime, in my estimation, the way in which we adapt to climate change in ways that are unfair and unjust.
Other than identifying those who are committing these crimes, should we prosecute them? How would we do that?
Well, I'm trying to use the term crime in a very broad and kind of persuasive way. In the beginning of the book, I go through a lot of different people who have been writing about climate change and commenting, and they all seem to use the language of crime. That's how I became interested in this in the first place. Mm-hmm. I was just reading about climate change to educate myself as a citizen, but the more I read, the more I was shocked by the language of crime being used continually. Now, most of the people were using this as sort of a symbolic device, right? An expressive term to convey their deep concern. So that's sort of the way in which I started to focus on this issue as a crime. I quote one criminologist in the book who says, to call something a crime is to register disapproval, fear, disgust, or condemnation in the strongest possible terms and to demand urgent remedies, but not necessarily the pain of criminal penalties. So I'm not sure the prosecution of individual fossil fuel executives is the right answer, although there are some that call for that. But again, to recognize that this is a crime, a morally blameworthy harm, and we have to respond to it, and we have to respond with urgent remedies. And so I'm hoping that by using the language of crime, I can heighten people's concern about this issue and to get them to understand that we do need to respond in very urgent ways. That doesn't necessarily involve criminal prosecution, but it does involve a lot of legalistic challenges. There's a tremendous amount of lawsuits being filed all around the world to force governments to act or to have fossil fuel companies pay for the harms that they've committed. Legal remedies are certainly in the mix there, but it's raising that broader issue of concern and urgent remedies to deal with the climate crisis.
We're in a election year. We have elections coming up. What do we need to hear from the candidates? What do we need to look for when we go to vote for someone in terms of this most important issue?
Well, do they think that the issue is an important issue, first and foremost?
Yeah.
Part of the problem that we have had the last 3 years is that the Trump administration believes that climate change is a hoax, that it's not real, that it's not happening, and they've taken no actions to mitigate carbon emissions. In fact, they've done the exact opposite. They've tried to encourage the fossil fuel industry to ramp up production, to extract more fossil fuels, and essentially to aggravate the problem. So the first thing in any candidate would be, do they take the issue seriously? Do they understand that we are in a crisis, that we are facing an emergency? And the second thing is, then, what kind of a plan do they have to address that, right? We need to see some kind of a serious, concrete climate action plan to respond to the emergency. If your house is on fire, you better try to do something about it, right? You better figure out how you're going to put out the fire and save lives and save your possessions. And as little Greta Thunberg has said, we have to act like our house is on fire because it is, right?
Yeah.
And so any politician has to first and foremost recognize that our house is on fire and then come up with a very concrete set of ideas about how to respond to and put out that fire. So that's what I would look for in any candidate, recognition of the issue and then a very serious and substantial plan to try to deal with it.
Thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us, Ron. I appreciate it. This is something that should very much be on all our minds. Was there anything that I didn't ask that you really wanted to add?
I guess the only thing that I would want to add in is that people, if they want to take action, if they want to get involved, I mean, we need a very broad-based social movement to deal with this crisis, and there are lots of ways that they can get engaged locally. On campus, we have a WMU working group on climate change that's been in existence since 2012. And so we've got an interdisciplinary group of people on campus that are working hard on the issue. Our working group is part of a broader Kalamazoo Climate Crisis Coalition that formed last summer and has been very active, just participated with the Earth Week Committee to put on a tremendous virtual Earth Week in our community. And so there are ways people can get involved through the working group, the Climate Crisis Coalition, through the Nature Center, through the Earth Week Committee. People just need to, if they want to work in this issue, there are a lot of ways they can get plugged in and contribute.
Good suggestions. Thank you so much, Ron. I appreciate it.
Sure thing.